This is 4:55 on Friday, October the 7th. Okay. So we will be spending a couple of weeks on the network layer, at least. So the overall topics are the service models, that is, what kind of quality of what sort of services and with what quality are they available from the perspective of the network layer. What is the difference between forwarding and routing? This is something that probably isn't completely universally agreed upon terminology, but it's worth talking about the two concepts separately, at least. How routing works, how routers work, scaling, and a little bit about IP version 6. I'm hoping that a new version of this textbook will come out pretty soon that will cover IP version 6 in much more detail, because I think we're finally getting close to the time when IP version 6 will be common. Yeah.
Just a quick question. For IPv6, is it 6 octets or is it 6 integer value or integer size?
Addresses?
Yeah.
They're 8 bytes.
8 bytes, okay.
Yeah, 8, yeah. The V6 doesn't refer to the size of anything, it's version 6.
Okay.
We're currently using version 4, and version 5 was abortive, so never went anywhere. Okay, and then how all this looks in the internet. So today we're going to talk about virtual circuits quite a bit, and that's a form of network layer that is sort of not publicly widely used at this point, but it is used inside the internet quite a bit. So it's kind of funny. We're going to talk about it as if it were a kind of networking that was available to end users, but you've probably never seen it before. And you probably won't ever see it as an end user, but if you go into the industry, you may end up working with it as something that supports the way the internet works. It's kind of weird how that's played out. So we'll talk about it. So it's worth seeing how that goes. Then we will talk about datagram networks, of course, and talk about routers, and then we'll talk about the IP protocol. So we talk about the internet a lot. We've talked about sort of higher level protocols up to now. We've mentioned a little bit about IP, but now we'll sort of get into the details of how that works and why it is the way it is. Then routing algorithms. We'll actually do our project with routing algorithms. We'll talk a little bit about routing in the internet. I think we have a lot of time to do that, but there are a few things to say. And then something about broadcast and multicast, which is sort of another fundamental issue in routing that's not just internet specific. Okay, so first of all, remember in our pictures of the network, we've shown network stacks that have the physical data link, network layer, and so on and so forth. We've concentrated up to now on the application transport layers, and notice that in these diagrams, the application and transport layers only show up in the end hosts, but all the pieces of the network have everything up through the network layer. Okay? That's important because what the network layer is all about is getting packets from where they come, where they start, to where they're going. And so there is work to do at the network layer throughout the network. Probably not a very deep observation, but so as in the higher layers, the technique here is that, you know, you have data coming from the higher layer, from the application layer. It's gotten packaged into a transport layer segment by putting some transport layer headers on it, right? And now we're going to pass that segment from the transport layer down to the application layer, where we'll add the pass it from the transport layer down to the network layer, where we'll add the add the network layer headers. So we're just growing the amount of data to be sent by a little bit. Stuff it into the data link layer, which will do more of the same, and send it off along its way to the first hop toward the destination, where we have to unpackage everything up through the network layer in order to understand the network work that needs to be done, repackage it, and send it on to the next hop. The router examines header fields in all IP datagrams passing through it. That should say the router examines IP header fields, right? It doesn't care about the transport layer fields for the most part. We'll get to that. So maybe this now is a good time to say this. So we're talking about layered models, right? Layered models of networking. Don't get too locked into that, right? That's everybody talks that way. You have to know that vocabulary. Mostly, networking works that way, but every once in a while it doesn't. Right? There are certain things that you can do in networks if you're willing to violate layering that you can't do otherwise. And we'll get to some of those uses later when we talk about things like NATs and firewalls and stuff. So they're not sacred. They're just a made-up... The layers are just a made-up conceptualization of networking that we often use to guide implementation, but not always. Okay, so the job of the network layer is to forward the packets from where they start to where they're going, and at each hop along the way, the routers, the boxes that are hooking one network to another one, are having to decide, given an input packet, what do I have to do with it? That's the forwarding piece, as you deal with each packet. Routing is the set of processes by which the forwarding is configured. So forwarding is a packet-by-packet operation. You get a packet, decide what to do with it. That's forwarding. Routing is a more global distributed algorithm that, given a network, figures out what the rules need to be for the forwarding. Okay. So we will, in our project, do some routing. Alright, so this just illustrates that idea that the routing algorithm populates a forwarding table, that when you get a packet, you look in the packet, you match it to something in the forwarding table that tells you this packet needs to go out on interface 2. Okay, so in some networks, things go a little bit differently than they do in IP networks. In IP networks, you formulate an IP packet, right? What's in an IP packet that tells it where it's going? We've seen this before. Just a destination, right? Says, I'm here, the destination's all the way over there, I throw this packet into the network, and the network figures out where it's got to go. And this, if I send another packet to that destination, it may go a completely different path. Doesn't matter. Some networks some networks are connection-oriented, which means that when I want to send packets over there, the first thing I do has nothing to do with the packets I want to send. The first thing I do is say, I want a connection to him. It's like a telephone call. Very much like a telephone call. First thing that we do is we say, connect to that device. And then after the network comes back and says it's connected, then we start sending the data. So in a connection-oriented network, the packets that I send don't say, after I've made the connection, they don't say send them to him. They say send on this connection. And the network hops along the way, all know about that connection, and sort of do the rules for that connection. They don't look at the destination, they just look at the connection ID. this is kind of an important point. We've talked about connections before, right, in terms of the transport layer, where in the transport layer, a connection is what? It's a, like a TCP stream. It's a connection that is implemented entirely by the end hosts, the source and destination. The network has no cognizance of that at all. Whereas in the network layer style connection, it's there for the purpose of informing the network level components what they're supposed to do. So that's sort of the difference. Are there any questions at this point? I'm sort of blithering on here with fairly blank faces in front of me. Connection-oriented and connectionless network services have different kinds of service models. You know, things that you would wish that you had from a network, wouldn't it be nice if I had guaranteed delivery? When I put a packet in the network, it gets to the destination. Even nicer if I could say, put it into the network and it'll get there in a certain amount of time. It would be nice if when I put a bunch of datagrams or packets into the network, they arrived at the destination at the same order that I sent them, etc., etc. You know what? The internet does none of these. But there are networks that do. So the service model name that we give to the internet is best effort. Now, that maybe is already misleading, right? It sort of suggests that the network will work really hard to deliver your packets. The best effort, if you think. No, it's much more casual than that. You give me a packet, we'll see. If it works, you win. If it doesn't, you don't. Of course, if a provider doesn't do a lot better than that, people will sort of not pay them for the service and they'll go away. But the internet's real rule is, you know, you throw it in, it goes where it goes, and if one of those places happens to be the destination, that's great, but it doesn't lose any sleep over throwing one away. Doesn't put in, if something gets into sort of the wrong location, it doesn't make any effort to put it back or anything like that. I don't like best effort as as the terminology. It really doesn't care that much. In so-called ATM networks, ATM stands for Asynchronous Transfer Mode, which is just a telephone jargon name whose components don't together make much sense unless you're into telephone jargon. So we just call it ATM. And it comes with a number of different service models that you could specify for a connection. It's a connection-oriented service. And you can say, when you set up the connection, I want this to be a constant bit rate connection, CBR. Over such a connection, you have a guaranteed bandwidth measured over a certain interval of time. It preserves ordering, it prevents losses, and it is not subject to congestion. Okay. Variable bit rate gives a range of values over which you're guaranteed to be able to send to the receiver. Again, it doesn't it is not subject to congestion. You see all of the ATM ones, the connection oriented ones, preserve order. They don't all prevent loss. You can get congestion. And usually loss is associated with the possibility of congestion. ABR stands for available bit rate. Again, this is sort of just telephone company jargon to a certain extent, but there's some intuition between constant variable and U, I think, says unassigned bit rate. So anyway, yeah.
Now, when it says guaranteed bit rate and guaranteed minimum, what's like the difference?
Yeah. So the CBR and VBR service models require that the customer obey his bit rate. Okay? So it's not just a guarantee from the provider to the customer, it's also a guarantee from the customer to the provider. ABR says the provider makes a guarantee of a minimum bit rate. The customer doesn't guarantee that that's only how fast he'll go, but so he can go faster and use available resources if they're there, but notice that he can get congestion feedback that tells him to slow down. Okay? And he probably gets a bill as well. Right? He gets a bill for the bandwidth that he uses. Okay, so let's see. Suppose you contract for a minimum 1 megabit a second, but you attempt to burst, you attempt to go 10 megabits a second, and it works. Okay? Well, that's great. You're using resources that otherwise wouldn't be used. The provider will bill you for 10 megabits a second, but he won't bill you as much for that kind of 10 megabits a second as he would for a constant bit rate 10 megabits a second, because he has the right to tell you to slow down, back down to the one. And U, I think, again, stands for unassigned. There's no guarantee. You can... I don't know. Don't remember. This slide is out of order. Another difference between transport layer and network layer network layer connections is that the service here is between the hosts and not between the applications. Notice that at the transport layer, we had the choice of whether to do connection-oriented or connectionless service. Here, there is no choice. The network is designed one way or the other. You don't have both. And the implementation here, of course, affects everything in the network, all the routers and switches and everything. Okay, so connection-oriented services use virtual circuits. So get familiar with the abbreviation VC. It's a technical term. It has nothing to do with venture capital these days, anyway. So it acts like a telephone circuit. The trick with virtual circuits is I said that when we send a packet on a virtual circuit, the thing we put it in is the virtual circuit identifier and not the destination, right? Because the destination has already been captured in the virtual circuit. So now when a router along the way gets a packet, it looks at the virtual circuit identifier and says, where am I supposed to send that? And there's an important point. I want to do here about this. So how does this look? So I have a connection, a virtual circuit, from this host to this host through these routers. And the trick, and this is easy to miss, so I'm going to point it out. The trick that they use is that the virtual circuit identifier or number changes as you go across multiple hops. So an ATM router or a virtual circuit router does the following. It looks at where the packet is coming from, that is on which interface. It looks at the virtual circuit number that's in the packet, that's part of the packet. And in this table, it finds a specification of the outgoing interface, 3 in this case, and a potentially different outgoing virtual circuit number. Now, the question is, why do they change the virtual circuit numbers? Very good. Very good. The shorter virtual circuit identifiers is certainly a useful characteristic, because then the overhead of sending the packets is lower. There's fewer bits consumed, and bits are time. But I think the bigger reason is the second one that you mentioned. Suppose that we didn't do that. Then what would we have to do? We have billions potentially of senders, billions of receivers, and lots of network in between. And suppose that every sender had... No, that's not the right way to put this. Suppose that the sender A has a connection to receiver C, and sender B has a connection to receiver D, and they're sort of widely separated in this network. Then what's the problem? The problem is that somehow they have nothing to do with each other, but they have to agree on virtual circuit identifiers that don't collide. And you have to do this for all the virtual circuits. So you have this big distributed computing problem of ensuring that you don't have collisions. So by doing it hop by hop, it's only a small distributed computing problem, and it's not even that much of a distributed computing problem, because on any given link, if these are point-to-point links at least, on any given link, they always are, on any given link, traffic going in that direction is completely under control of that host. So it can pick any old virtual circuit number it wants. It can manage that address space, if you will. And so there's really no problem avoiding collisions, because it's just under the control of one host.
And so each router after that decides the next.
Yeah, so you, as part of connection setup, what happens is that there are messages that are sent that say, okay, I'm sending you traffic. I'm trying to set up connection that goes to him, and the traffic that I'm going to send to you is going to come with virtual circuit ID such and such. And the routing piece then, as part of connection setup, decides that he wants to send next here, and so he sends a message here that says, I'm sending traffic to him, and the virtual circuit ID I'm going to use for that is 22. Okay?
Is there a reason why 3 out of the 4 that you show there actually are just incremented by 10 from the incoming and outgoing? Is there a pretty normal pattern to it, or is it
no.
random, pseudo random?
It's an example that they made up.
Okay.
I think they picked numbers out of their heads. No, there's no. there need be no rhyme or reason. So, just to, show how this goes, he's sending him, we initiate a call, it's routing now that governs the path that is taken by the call initiation packets that eventually make their way to the destination, where, like on a phone, you have the option of rejecting the call. I don't want to talk to you. No resources consumed in the network in that case. You don't want that to happen. You reply. The reply together, the initiation and the accept message set up the route, and then you can begin flowing. Another place that you see this, but again it's at the application level, is if you ever play with voice over IP, it uses a very similar sort of call setup scheme, the SIP, session initiation protocol. It's an application level protocol in the internet. But it's the same sort of idea. You send the message potentially through several different application level routers now that pass this thing along. It's kind of crazy how it works. But eventually you get to the destination who says, I accept the call or I don't. And you get a message back saying, anyway. Okay, so another way to say what I said before is in datagram networks, connectionless, there's no call setup. The routers have no idea who you're talking to. They have no idea what path the data is taking. They don't care. Different packets can go different routes through the network. They can get reordered. They can get dropped. no bandwidth guarantees. All right, there's not really anything surprising on that slide, I think. The network has no idea that there's a connection here. So TCP, which is a transport layer connection, doesn't show up at all as a connection in the internet. At the internet level, it's just best effort packet delivery. Question? So notice that the implication of this. The implication of this is that things are not so simple for the datagram network about forwarding, because they haven't agreed ahead of time where packets are supposed to go. The only information they get is the destination. So the forwarding tables in datagram networks are more complicated. So they might look like something like this. You have a lot of bits here, and I don't quite know why they did it that way, but they did. Bits. You look at this and you say, all right, all the traffic up to this in this range goes out on a particular link. The next block of addresses go out on some other link. Another block goes out on another link. And finally, we have a default routing rule. Okay? Well, we're going to look at routing tables in computers here in a little bit.
So this has something to do with... Where did these come from? Are these like this range of addresses are closest going this way?
Well, these table entries come from the routing algorithms, which have various ways of figuring out what they should be. And that, when we'll talk about routing algorithms in great detail, but it has to do with. For example, one goal might be to find the shortest path that a packet could take. That's the usual one. But there are others that other ways of getting routing table entries. There might be restrictions that, since I'm sending traffic inside my company, I want to use only my company's resources for doing that and not the public internet, even though the paths might be shorter. That sort of stuff. If you look at that previous slide and compare it to this one, you'll be able to tease out that we really don't have to say quite so much detail here. Right? We gave range 32-bit ranges here. It's usually the case, but not always, that what we're interested in is things that just match a certain number of bits. So we look at the destination address, we see which entry in our table that matches. We always look for the longest one that matches, and use that one. So in this one, which interface does this go out on? Well, it matches rule for 0, I think. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. Okay? And that's the longest match in the table. So we use interface 0. But what about this one? No, that's going to be interface 1 because it matches all of that. It also matches this one, but this one's longer.
And this is just done at the hardware level, like bitwise operation, right?
Or it can be. You know, really fast routers will do it that way. But you can build software routers as well. But yeah, for on a 32-bit machine, you can do this matching pretty quickly. Well, you can do the matching pretty quickly. The dealing with a big routing table can get expensive. So the world has settled on the datagram network for the internet. And we can ask ourselves why that might be. I think the answer lies in some combination of the following. Using datagram networks, we're really relying on what we talked about way back at the beginning of statistical multiplexing. Right? We're able, without a lot of sort of management overhead, to use relatively large fractions of the resources available in the network. Sort of without worrying about it. So it's pretty easy to do. So that it's easy to be fairly efficient in our use of resources. Virtual circuit networks can be more efficient in their use of resources, right? Because you can sort of carve things up and get to close to 100% utilization with these reservations based on connections. But it takes a lot of work to do that. And there's a lot of mechanism in virtual circuit networks that cause a lot of complication for the end hosts.
I would imagine that the virtual circuit networks wouldn't scale as easily either. Is that a bad assumption? If you just want to plug in more systems into the...
I think with the virtual circuit number, the local virtual circuit numbers, that's not so much of an issue. But the management of the things doesn't scale. That's really the problem. When you want to make a connection to somebody in China, you know, everybody along the way sort of has to agree on that path, and everybody expects to get paid. That was the other thing they did, right? Was that they said everybody expects to get paid for everything. So that's okay. Well, the other claim here is that the internet is made for smart end systems. That was computers. Well, today, notice that everything has a computer in it. So everything's smart. Phones are smart. So this advantage of ATM, that it could deal with dumb telephones, became sort of not an advantage at all because telephones got smart. And so a lot of the stuff they did in ATM that made the network itself complex and hard to build in favor of these dumb end systems just turned out to not to be an issue. Simple inside the network, complexity at the edge. Okay. But ATM does have the advantage of being able to provide better service guarantees. And so ATM is widely used inside IP networks. You just never see it. Right? When Sprint wants to talk to, when Sprint wants to carry traffic from Seattle to Portland and Chicago and Salt Lake City and so forth, they will set up ATM connections and they will pump the IP traffic that they get through those ATM connections because they give them much better control over the resources being used on their fibers. But you never see that at the edge. And you never see ATM-ish telephones. ISDN telephones were popular, started to get popular about 15 years ago, and then they faded away pretty much in favor of VoIP phones. I don't see much interest in ISDN phones anymore. ISDN was a telephony service that could easily interface with ATM, but didn't. Question?
With that example you gave, would you mean that Sprint only owns both of those points?
Yes, Sprint owns both of those points. And when they want to talk to somebody else, they don't do ATM. So that's sort of how the world has evolved. So next time, we will get much more into the way routers work and how, and we will definitely get through or well into IP and IP addressing. So 4.3 and 4.4. And then after that, we'll talk about the routing algorithms, and then really at that point, you'll be ready to start the project. So I don't think it'll be another 2 weeks before I post the project. Yeah.
What language is the project going to be in?
This project you can do in any language you like.
We've only done one project so far, right?
Right.
Making sure that there wasn't in line in the middle.
No, you slept through the second one. I'm sorry.
This is project number 8, didn't you know?
Any language means MIPS.
Yeah. Any language as long as it's
MIPS. As long as it's MIPS.
MIPS.
Assembly.
Oh, no. I don't do that to anybody except in 260.
Any language within the MIPS subrom.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
If you want to look at characters, you don't have to look at old characters like
question about when you're saying the network layer, well, like I guess on the slides when it kind of pointed out that the network layer has to choose either or for either connection oriented or connectionless, isn't that still how the transport layer is sort of? Like you still have to choose.
Well, yeah, in the transport layer, you have to choose one or the other. For a given use of the transport layer, you have to choose one or the other.
Okay.
But you can do either transport layer kind over either network layer kind. See what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at.
Okay.
There.
Yeah, because I was like, wait a second.
Yeah. Actually, there is one protocol, transport layer protocol, that tries to be both. Not very popular.
Guys, So I wouldn't.
Excuse me. Hi.